Hello and welcome to the Impact podcast from us at Impact Wales. We're Finn and Jane, and every week we'll be bringing you the very best professional learning to help you make an impact in your school. Our in conversation with guest today is Harry Fletcher Wood. Welcome, Harry.
Thanks for having me.
Who is a teacher, researcher and teacher educator. He's worked in England, Japan, India and Sweden, and is fascinated by making things better and the social, psychological and structural changes this requires. He now works at TeacherTap, helping schools better understand teachers' needs. So we're delighted to speak to you today, Harry. Welcome to the Impact podcast, especially about such an important subject as children's habits. And I know that you've recently written a book, and I'm going to do something that we probably should have prepared for earlier. I'm going to have to rush across the office now and get the book. So don't go anywhere,
which we've read cover to cover.
I was going to say, I'm disappointed it's not sitting at your desk at all times.
Yeah. So you're just listening, Finn has no hold of
it. Yeah, I literally just ran across the office there because it was on my desk rather than where we do our podcast. So your book is absolutely fascinating. Before we get into it, one of the things that I just kind of wanted to mention is your Twitter feed has been something that we have followed probably almost as long as we've been on Twitter, so 6+ years, because one of the things we love about your Twitter feed is that it looks at research and it gives the practical implications of those research, but you don't limit yourself to educational research. You're looking at research that has an implication for education. So tell us a little bit about your background and what you're interested in, particularly in as far as the research and education.
Yeah, that's a slightly tricky question. So I'm a history teacher by trade, and then was asked to be responsible for professional development within my school, and got really interested in what should we be asking teachers to do? How can we best help them to do that? And started writing blogs. This is, I think, eight years ago now. I started writing sort of blog posts about just what I was learning. And that just spiraled into sort of falling into a rabbit hole of this research, and then sharing this research with others. And I'd say, I mean, there's a huge amount. If you're ever privileged enough to be given some time just to read, which obviously is a classroom teacher, you know, another dozen books to mark and, you know, whatever, but there's loads that you can read within disciplines like cognitive science and assessment that you're like, wow, I wish I knew this 5 years ago, and I can use this. But there's also loads that you can take from adjacent disciplines, and actually one of the ideas that I find really useful in thinking about any form of anything that you're trying to do where you're working with people is working out what the endemic problems are. So what are the things that all teachers struggle with? So for example, every teacher, no matter how good you are, from time to time has some students in the classroom who aren't necessarily as motivated as they might wish. And if we can find universals like that, and my understanding is that this is universal, my friend Lucy Crahan, who visited places like Japan and South Korea and Singapore and Finland, and she said she saw students who were off task in every single one of those countries. It's just a universal, because we don't all want to do the same thing at the same time. If we can find those, then we can, you know, come up with useful things that teachers can use. And actually, lots of other domains of public service particularly face similar challenges that we do. So, you know, we're trying to get students to do their homework or whatever, and at the same time doctors are trying to get patients to take their medicines at regular times.
Do you know, it's funny that you should mention that, sorry for interrupting you.
That's
that,
all right.
Actually, one of the things that we had on our list to talk about today, that one of the pieces of research that you had on your Twitter feed that actually influenced something that we did with our people that we're working with in Wales, was talking about people taking up flu jabs. Do you remember?
It's very apt. Do you have your flu jab?
I am actually
good. Glad to hear it.
I've actually written in my diary, and that will be evident when you talk about it. So, what is it about that particular piece of research that was interesting to you?
I mean, so this is a study where they it was a company in the States, and they'd put on free flu vaccination clinics. So anyone in the company could pitch up. So the question the researchers were working on was, how do we make it more likely that people do pitch up? And clearly there are some people, as we know, who just, you know, I don't want a vaccination. And that, you know, that's fine. I mean, it's not fine, but you know, that's, yeah, those people are harder to tackle. And I was actually talking to a doctor the other week who was having one-to-one conversations with her colleague. So some people are going to need that, but many people don't do a thing just because they're busy and they meant to, they get to the end of the day and forgot. And so in this case, they sent three different flyers, essentially. So flyer one was like, here are when the shots are, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Flyer two was, here are when the shots are. Many people find it useful to write down when they're going to go. And flyer three was, many people find it useful to write down exactly when they're going to go, like what time. And people, and that was all they did. So as you randomly were allocated to either get no hint like this, a hint to write the date and a hint to write the date and time. And people who got the date and time thing were more likely to then turn up for the flu shot. And it's just, well, it's really interesting on a few levels. One, there are big and complicated things we can do to encourage vaccination, but if you're sending everyone a flyer anyway, you can, and you can get a few more people to go, you might as well do things like that. Two, what I like to analogize this to is homework, right? So I must have set thousands of homeworks, you know, do this by Friday, whatever, and I never once said to students, and write down, as well as writing down what I need you to do, write down when and where you're going to do it. And yet that simple act would have made them a lot more likely to, would have saved me so much hassle and chasing up later. And so it's a really good example. I've seen a few things in this line, but I've not yet seen any study in schools that does exactly this. But if it works, we've got research from loads of other domains. If it works for people in loads of other situations, it's got to be worth a try. It doesn't cost us anything, really. And potentially really powerful.
And I think this is what's really, really interesting about your book, is that in your book, Habits of Success, you're talking about how can we encourage pupils to carry out behaviours that will actually help them be better learners, help them be more successful at their learning. And I think there's this idea, and it's a common trope that people just talk about this thing. For example, if you're going to encourage pupils to be more resilient, there's almost this expectation that, well, we'll just expose them to a bit more challenge and they'll almost get it by osmosis, that they'll just be there. But actually, what your book is talking about is very much about teaching pupils, like we were talking about with the flu vaccine. And it feels, in a way, a little bit more like parenting. But in fact, that's what teaching is often about, isn't it? Is you're teaching behaviours, you're training pupils to actually be independent and do all of these things for themselves. So you talk a lot about powerful habits. What actually are powerful habits?
I should start by saying that the justification for focusing on habits is loads of what we do day to day is habitual. So if you think about the way that you drive to work, or what you have for breakfast, or how you start a lesson, or whatever it is, maybe you've just moved house, or maybe you've just taken up a healthy eating routine. But most of what you do most of the time, most days, is pretty similar day to day. And so when trying to influence behavior, it is really a question of influencing habits, because we don't just want students to try hard once. We want them to try hard whenever they're challenged. But habits take time to change and time and effort to change. And so the idea of powerful habits is saying, well, you know, I don't have the time and the energy to try and like think really hard about every single thing that students do in the classroom. What are the handful of things that are going to make a massive difference if students do them regularly? And the formulation for a powerful habit that I suggest is it's got to be simple enough to stick, and it's got to be meaningful enough to make a significant difference. So simple enough to stick, if the habit is like, first do this, then do this, then do that, then do the other, and remember to, you know, I'm not going to follow that.
We're lost already.
So potentially something really simple, like, you know, what is it that students should do when they finish a piece of work or when they're stuck? And a really simple thing, like, every time you finish a piece of work, go through this checklist and make sure you've done X, Y, and Z. Whenever you're stuck, first do X, Y, and Z, and then see your hand up. And then in terms of being meaningful enough to make a difference, so, well, okay, what specific things can we ask students to do at that point that are really going to make a difference to what they learn? So our checklist might include check that the date and title is there, and that is worthwhile because if it saves me marking put date and title on for the 100th time, that's a good thing. But more usefully, what are the things that we can ask students to do that, that will ensure the work is really good? And so, like, go back and look at the model that we looked at for this piece of work to make sure that the piece of work is really good. Swap work with a peer and see, you know, what they've done, what you've done, and what you could take from their work. And so it's finding things that, if we ask students to do them consistently, are going to hopefully transform their what they achieve in school, and will stick with them and will make a lasting difference.
I suppose from a whole school's perspective as well, it's being having that consistency across the whole school, not just some different habits in different classrooms as well.
So this is interesting. I'm working with a school on this next week who are trying to do some of the stuff out of the book. And you've got this tension with actually people, teachers want to do their own thing, right? And actually the habits I want my history students to have are probably different from the habits that you want as a maths teacher, whatever. On the other hand, we know essentially that habits build through repetition. And so the more we can say, actually, what we want you to do at the start of a history lesson is the same as the start of a maths lesson, an English lesson, whatever, the easier we make it for students. Whereas if they have to remember, oh, it's history, so I need to write the date on the left-hand side, not the right-hand side, it's much harder for them.
And then you start to have your subject specialism habits as those habits are really, you know, embedded and they develop.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we know that lots of the things that matter most are subject specific, and that's why we teach in different subject disciplines. If whatever we can make generic and make an easy habit do, and then save our energies as history teacher, geographer, or whatever, for the things that really are special about learning our subject.
Yeah, so it's setting the foundations, and then you've got something on which to build, because it really doesn't matter if you come in as a history teacher and say, well, we've got to do this, but the habit isn't there. It's a little bit pointless. And you talk about pupils valuing the change. And that is important, because we can't forget that as teachers, sometimes we might say, I want you pupils to do this, and it feels a little bit imposed on them, but it's really important that they value it as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happens?
Yeah, so I first of all, in the book, I say I have a bit of a pop at motivation, because I say, actually, we spend too much time saying, I want my students to be motivated. And that's not really what we mean. What we want our students to do is like do whatever the thing is, because motivation is really fickle. So, you know, like today I'm motivated to work really hard, and tomorrow I'm tired and I'm not motivated. And so relying on getting 30 students all with different hopes, dreams, fears, wishes, all motivated by the same thing simultaneously is a chimera, basically. But we do, as you're completely right to say, you know, they're not going to get started unless they see some value in it. And so there are two particular points that I try and make. The first is that I think we rely too much sometimes on the rationale. So we give students, you know, here's a really good reason why this is worthwhile doing this. Yeah. And, you know, it'll be useful for a future career and, you know, so on and so on. And that is completely correct, but it's not, there's no emotional pull there. Like, well, actually, I'm 12 and I'm not that interested in my future career, or I'm 12 and I've already decided I'm going to be...
It's almost a decade away, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm going to be a YouTube streamer anyway, so you know, whatever you say.
Going into my dad's firm, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the question is, how can we make the thing seem meaningful to students right now? There's loads of stuff in the book, but two things that I think are particularly important. One is this idea of immediacy. So we're motivated by immediate rewards, and we like to defer anything that's not rewarding. And that's why we ice cream when we know we shouldn't, and that's why we procrastinate, because it's a lot easier and more fun to like do something else than do the difficult task we don't want to do. And teachers are in the hardest position, because they are doing, the entire role of teaching is saying, I want you to work hard now for future rewards. So one thing that I think is worth considering is, how can we bring the rewards forward? So instead of saying, this is going to be really useful in 5 years' time, 2 years' time, for your GCSEs, whatever it is, this is going to be really useful and exciting, because at the end of the lesson, you're going to feel really proud and you're going to have understood this thing, and so on and so on. And likewise, if we can sort of defer the pain, and so, you know, really simple things, like instead of saying, answer these 20 questions, say, right, answer the first three questions. Now, after the first three questions, we say, brilliant, do another three. But we've diminished the size of the task. The other big thing that I talk about is social influences. And we, you know, if you're in a crowded theatre and everyone around you stands up and walks out, you're not just going to sit there on your own being like, well, I wonder why they're all, you're going to go and do something about it. And so in the same vein, any time we can show that the actions we're promoting, the learning we're encouraging is in some way socially encouraged. So that could be role models, that could be social norms saying like, look around you. Most of your peers are handing in their homework on time. Now that there are lots of caveats to that because it's very easy to get a kind of, well, I don't want to be like them anyway. But this, I took my son to physio yesterday in a small group, and every time there's a thing that he doesn't want to do, which is pretty much all of them, and I'm like, oh, look, Jibreel across there is doing this thing. And he'll be like, actually, that looks fun. And I'm just going to try and do it. He's three, but everyone, you know, we're all prey to these same influences. So, yeah, the immediacy of reward and social influences are two things that I think are really worth considering.
And that's really interesting that you talk about the process of learning and what makes learning happen. It's not just about you know, what goes in through your brain and how you attend to it, and then, you know, how easy it is to pick up and things like that. It is also what's going on around you, how you feel about the people around you. And I was just thinking,
can't separate the two.
No, I was just thinking, you know, in Welsh universities, I went to a Welsh university, and you have to do three subjects in your first year. You've got a slightly broader experience, I think, elsewhere. And I did psychology in my first year, and I was absolutely fascinated by it. And it just strikes me that teachers these days probably need far more experience in a much wider range of kind of disciplines like psychology, like human behavior, in order to really provide the best experience for learners in their classroom. It's a really tall order for teachers, but the more they can hear these kinds of ideas about, you know, behavior does matter, what the person sitting next to you does matter, and that can be utilized by the teacher, I think that's really, really important. Could you tell us a little bit, just to kind of finish up this section of the podcast, we want to talk to you about something else in a minute. You talk as well about a very practical approach to showing pupils how to work through a particular task or how to work through a particular process by actually using the idea of worked examples. Can you just tell us a little bit how that works in this kind of sphere of behaviour?
I guess the key point to make is just that we learn, say we begin learning by imitation. And I think we forget that, particularly when we get to secondary school and beyond, because we want our students to be original and creative and so on, and realize, you know, if you go to the Picasso Museum, and Picasso spent years and years of time painting in quite traditional ways, and B, just, you know, copying things, and then started to play about with it. And so the bottom line I'd suggest is anything that you want people to do, you need to show them how to do it. And if you can't show them how to do it, you can't expect them to do it. So in terms of a worked example, we're familiar with the value of worked examples in sort of academic teaching, as it were, like here's how to do this sum, now your turn, here's a slightly different one, and building from that to independence. But yeah, I think we can do exactly the same thing in terms of behavior, and it could be really simple things to say, you know, you're really upset and you're raising your voice, do you notice that although I'm a little bit upset, I'm keeping my tone really level? And the thing is, people won't necessarily notice that, particularly if they're upset, unless we draw attention to it, because I'd argue that just as we're experts in mathematics or Welsh or whatever it is, we're also more expert in behavior than our students, and more able to kind of analyze what's going on. So yeah, I think we need to demonstrate and plan out and let students practice the things we want them to do. That is the only way that we learn.
Absolutely. And I think there's such a wealth of information in your book, and some a really very straightforward step-by-step process that teachers can pick up and think about in their own context and really try those things out. So we would heartily recommend people buying your book,
particularly with all the references to the research at the back of the book that you've put in there, because I think we're so used to be able to access maybe our subject specific research, but looking at that wider sphere, that all, you know, all the research that we talked about in, during the session today, that you might want to go away and read and have a look at as well.
So moving on a little bit, we know that well, we talked about at the beginning of the podcast that we have a new curriculum coming here in Wales, and we know that you've had a little bit of involvement in that. Can you tell us a little bit about what involvement you have had so that people know what position that you're talking from?
So another sort of strand of my work has been looking at the evidence around professional development, and I was part of a team who, well, I was part of a team who did a big systematic review over the last year, but I was also part of a project for the Welsh Government looking at the COVID catch-up work and providing some research summaries, and then running some workshops around, well, what should or what could effective professional development look like if we want to use it to help students catch up.
And I think that that is a key question in Wales at the moment. We're interestingly, literally just after we get talking to you, we're going to talk to James McEnany from Scotland, who's written a book all about curriculum for excellence and what's gone wrong, what's gone right, so that we can try and learn from that. But one of the things that is really important at the moment for teachers in Wales is professional learning. So what do you think the key challenges are for Wales when we're thinking about professional learning for curriculum for Wales? That's a big question.
So that's a big question. Let me start by saying what I think the key challenges for professional development generally are.
Yeah.
And then maybe we can make it a little bit more specific. So I find it easiest to think about effective professional development as being something that combines three things. You have to get the what, the how, and the implementation right. So the what is, what do you want teachers to do, or what do you want students to do in the classroom? And there are plenty of studies of professional development out there that have tried to encourage teachers to do things that are not necessarily particularly productive. So for example, we have funded studies into approaches which said, kind of just let students collaborate with each other and talk less in the classroom. And then you read the report and it's like, well, the teachers hated it because it didn't, and like it diminished achievement. We've also had studies which sort of just don't have a clear set of things they want teachers to do. It just said, if we put teachers in the room together, that'll be useful. And unfortunately, it's a nice idea, but it's generally not, because you need some focus that you're working on, even if that just sort of guides the conversation. So you have to get the what right. And my suggestion there is that is really rooted in the science of learning and the experience of formative assessment and responsive teaching. You then have to get the how right. So like, how are we going to help teachers to change? So you can have the most brilliant science of learning informed, let's all use work examples or retrieval practice or whatever it is, but unless you have a way of making this usable, easy, attractive to teachers, helping teachers change their habits, it's not going to work. And then thirdly, this implementation piece is, you know, well, I mean, Mike Tyson probably put it best, that everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. It's like, you have this, oh, I'm going to, you know, going to run these workshops that are going to really help teachers. And then you realize teachers are busy and there's a fire alarm when you're in the middle of the day and so on and so on. So just getting the details of the implementation right in order to make sure that the teachers get the experience that you want them to get, and that experience works for them. What does that mean for Wales? I guess if anyone can do the how part, it's making, although not everyone does, it's making sure the what part is right. I am not an expert in curriculum development or in the curriculum for Wales, but I think the list of things that you could ask teachers to do that they're not already doing that's really going to improve their pedagogy maybe isn't as long as you might want it to be. And I guess it's making sure that what they're being asked to do through the curriculum for Wales is really the stuff that's well informed by science of learning, cognitive science, and is genuinely sort of usable and useful for teachers and for students.
Yes, and I know that Welsh Government has a focus on research. So we've got a new research capacity strategy out there that's thinking about higher ed involvement in research and making sure that teachers are researched informed. We've got the MPET project, which is all about encouraging teachers to carry out research in their own classroom. But that's not quite the same as providing them with the techniques, the tools, the strategies that actually make a difference to learning. And I think that's the kind of the key question at the moment in Wales. Have we actually got that professional learning in place?
Is the what?
Yeah.
Right. Have we got the what?
Yeah.
I think one of the things that makes me nervous, definitely, there was a big push a few years ago in England around a sort of teachers as researchers. Everyone should be reading research papers and running their own research trials in the classroom. And that's something we took from medicine that maybe we shouldn't have taken. I think the thing that makes that analogy interesting is that in medicine, you undergo 5, or depending on how you want to look at it, 7 years of training. And in year one, you do, you know, a whole load of like, how does the body work? What is the biology of humans? Yeah. What is, you know, pharmacology, all this kind of thing. And if you've already got 7 years knowledge and experience, then saying, go and read a paper and see what you think of it, run your own trial is quite feasible. In teaching, we have a year's training, 90% of which is time in the classroom. So actually, you don't spend a huge amount of time being taught, well, this is how the brain works, this is what helps us to learn, and so on. And so if you then say to people, go and read these, and I have read hundreds of research articles, and there are very few that I would wish on a classroom teacher, just because you can get to the end of one, you've spent like an hour trying to understand it. I'm not a statistician. And then you've got to the end of it, and it's kind of, well, we still don't know. And so you haven't walked away with a sort of a practical, this is what I can do next. And so I think we need to make sure that we all as teachers have that grasp of the fundamentals of psychology, memory, and so on, before we then say, let's run our own
before we make
research trials. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something that's certainly replicated in some of the experiences that we've had providing professional learning for teachers in Wales, that you get teachers who've been teaching, you know, 5, 10, 20, 25 years, and they're still very much novices in, you know, when we ask the question, well, how does learning happen? Very, very few sometimes can actually articulate that. And you would think that as it's their, you know, it's our bread and butter, that that should be front and center of any kind of understanding for a teacher. They need to know how that mechanism works so that they then can think about which elements of it do they need to improve and change. So
it was never on the curriculum, was it, when you were learning to become a teacher? So all of a sudden it's evolved now over the last couple of years, and it's really crucial.
It's really interesting you mentioned that, because I use that specific question when I work with teacher educators, and the first thing I say about it is like, I have written a book about this, and I still find it hard to articulate in clear, comprehensible ways how people learn. And the second thing I say is, I don't know, 7-8 years into teaching before I really thought about that question. And it wasn't for want of sitting in sessions. I say, do this, it's engaging, do this with your boys, do that, this, that, and the other. But we don't necessarily grasp, and partly because it's really hard, but also we haven't attended enough to that question, I don't think, as a profession.
I think we've certainly found over the past couple of years that there are things that we did in our teaching practices when we were at school, at working in a school, and now you look back and think, ah, that's why I did it, because I knew that worked, because we now know the research. But at that point in time, you just sort of evolve, or you observe a really good teacher within the school or department doing the same thing, and you try that with your classroom, and you sort of develop those sort of techniques.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a lot of time for the wisdom of practice here, and you can definitely turn up with your like, oh, I've got some cognitive science, and you talk to the veteran, they're like, well, yes, I mean, I've been doing this since 1998. Yeah. Thanks very much. Equally, I do think it's worth understanding the principles that allows you to play tunes on it, and particularly because some elements of the science of learning are really counterintuitive. So some of the stuff around desirable difficulties, where we're going to say, we're going to make it harder, and we're going to diminish students or depress student performance in the first instance in order to help them learn more later, and that isn't necessarily something that you'd learn through trial and error, because you try it and you're like, well, students are doing worse,
not so doing that one again.
and we could talk about the cognitive science and the science of learning, and as you say, it's one of those subjects that you never really get to the end of, because it is so complex and complicated. Harry, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you this afternoon even. Thank you so much, and we would thoroughly recommend people go out and have a look at your book, Habits of Success. really interesting, especially in Wales, because we have this, you know, this expectation that we're going to turn out these amazing adults, and it's one way of getting that done. So thank you, Harry, for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been really interesting talking to you. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to make sure you don't miss future episodes. You can find us online at www.impact.wales. You can also follow us on social media. On Twitter, we're at Impact Wales. On Facebook and Instagram, search for Impact Wales. And on LinkedIn, search for Impact School Improvement.